Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Chefs, go to the wok and get all the cooked beef. Slice it. Put it in jus. Get it now. Get all 32 chickens. Get them searing, roasting, peanut, sausages, burgers, hot dogs, everything on the grill. Fire everything right now.
Yes, chef. Chef.
Fat, contribute in any way humanly possible.
That's a scene from Hulu's new TV series, The Bear, a dramatic behind-the-scenes look at a fictional Chicago restaurant struggling to stay open. The show has won rave reviews for its gritty realism and how it tackles issues that continue to challenge the restaurant industry: low pay, long hours, and high-pressure working conditions. We're talking about how the restaurant industry, the second-largest private sector employer in the U.S., is working to reinvent itself. Saru Jayaraman is president of One Fair Wage, a national organization working to raise wages for service workers nationwide. Her August 7 essay in the New York Times is titled "Hulu's The Bear and the Restaurant Industry's Long Overdue Reckoning." Welcome to the show, Saru.
Thank you for having me.
You refer to the industry as working to reinvent itself because it has to.
That's right. It's going through a massive upheaval right now. Decades, actually, frankly, generations of incredibly low pay that date all the way back to emancipation of slavery, and very long hours, lots of pressure, and, you know, treatment of these workers, this workforce, as disposable rather than the professional, the skilled professionals that they are, has finally caught up with itself. And workers in the millions are leaving. And we're finding thousands of employers actually raising wages and changing practices to recruit and retain staff in the worst staffing crisis in the history of the U.S.
There's so much to talk about. In your essay for the New York Times, you wrote that you were initially reluctant to watch The Bear. Why was that?
You know, it's not just television. Our culture, and you saw this a lot during the pandemic, there's a lot of focus on chefs. There's a lot of focus on the employer, on the chef, who's often male, more often than not white. When the vast majority of workers are the ones who put the food on our table, who are the ones who actually serve us, who are struggling to survive. You know, we heard and sympathized with so many wonderful restaurant owners that struggled during the pandemic. We didn't hear half as many stories about the workers who struggled to feed their kids and keep a roof over their heads and pay their bills. And frankly, because we didn't pay enough attention to workers is why they started leaving. And we're having to deal with that right now.
We did invite the National Restaurant Association to join us for this show or provide a statement in response to the New York Times essay by our guest, Saru Jayaraman, but they were said they were unable to provide anyone today. John Barker of the Ohio Restaurant Association had a scheduling conflict and was unable to join. If you have a question or comment, you want to join this conversation today, we certainly do welcome restaurant workers, former restaurant workers of any stripe, to give us a call and give us your impression of how the industry is changing and why it should or shouldn't. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. The main character is Chef Carmi. He's played by actor Jeremy Allen White. He's white, although it is a mixed race cast. Your group has reported on workers of color in the restaurant industry and how they experience lower pay and tips than their white counterparts. Now, we can draw a line back, you know, pretty significantly, and you mentioned back to the end of, you know, legal enslavement in the United States. Do that, but also it's not going away. So it affects everybody in the industry, but it still affects people of color more.
That's right. So look, tipping originated in feudal Europe. It was something that aristocrats and nobles gave to their serfs and vassals, but always on top of a wage. These folks got wages or salaries, and tips were a bonus. When the idea came to the States, it came right around the time of emancipation. And at emancipation, the restaurant industry basically wanted to continue slavery. They wanted to hire Black people for free, Black women in particular. And so they mutated tipping in America only from being an extra bonus on top of a wage, as it was always intended, and I think as most consumers intended, to becoming a replacement for wages, to becoming the wage itself. And we started with a $0 wage at emancipation for Black workers. It's gone up to $2 and 13 cents an hour at the federal level and just over $4 in Ohio, Ohio persists as one of 43 states with a sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. Now, there are seven states that got rid of this, including Minnesota. Their industries are booming. They have a full wage for workers with tips on top, higher restaurant sales, higher small business growth. They lost fewer restaurants during the pandemic, higher rates of tipping, and by the way, one half the rate of sexual harassment, because this is an overwhelmingly female population of servers and bartenders. The majority of restaurant workers, both in the kitchen and the front, are women. And as you said, it continues to disproportionately impact people of color. They do work in more casual restaurants where they earn less money, they earn less tips, but also data shows that they get tipped less even when they provide perfect service.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The, you know, it's a fascinating story about the tipping system in the U.S. because when you travel overseas, you know, you always have to ask, what's the culture here? What's the traditions here? Because it's so different. And why has tipping persisted as a form of compensation? I mean, at some point, when you describe it that way, it sounds utterly ridiculous.
Yeah, well, something happened in that history that I forgot to mention, which is that a couple of decades after emancipation, an association was formed to maintain this system of tipping replacing wages. It's called the National Restaurant Association. We call it the other NRA. It was formed in 1919 just specifically to actually suppress wages, both for agricultural workers and restaurant workers. And it's driven by the chains, the IHOPs, the Denny's, the Applebee's. It's been around now for over 100 years, fighting and arguing that this is the only industry that shouldn't have to pay its own workers because we, the customers, should pay their workers' wages for us, for them. So, you know, they've been incredibly powerful in lots of state legislatures, in Congress, which is why in so many states right now, we're actually putting this directly to voters. We're putting it on the ballot. And I wanted to share that Michigan just became the eighth state to end the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. And I think Ohio can follow. Michigan just declared that the sub-minimum wage is over. And so in Michigan, workers are going to get $12 an hour plus tips, and then it's going up to 15 in 24.
And the proof will be in the proverbial pudding about whether or not restaurants are forced to shut down
I mean, you're not that far from Minnesota. Minnesota restaurants are already paying, you know, anywhere from 12 to 15 plus tips. And there are plenty of restaurants in Minnesota. Minneapolis is booming.
What do we know about the factors that influence how much people tip in this country?
Yes. Unfortunately, there's now been mountains of evidence that disabuse us of the idea that tipping is entirely based on the quality of service. There's a professor at Cornell University, Michael Lynn, who has collected just decades of tipping data from big companies and small companies. And it shows that, unfortunately, tipping is mostly based on the race and gender of the server, not the quality of the service. Men always get tipped more than women. White people always get tipped more than people of color, even when they provide what's called perfect service. And I think this became particularly evident during the pandemic. You know, during the pandemic, 6 million workers lost their jobs. Two-thirds reported that they actually couldn't get unemployment insurance because in most states like Ohio, they were told their wages were too low to qualify for benefits.
And their tips didn't count.
Their tips didn't count.
Even though they're supposed to be taxed on them.
That's right. That's right. And then they went back to work. They found tips had gone way down. The vast majority of workers said, look, sales are down, so tips are way down. But harassment has gone way up. You know, thousands of women reported, I'm regularly asked, take off your mask so I can see how cute you are before I decide how much I want to tip you, which, you know, just why would you need to see her face if it's about the quality of the service? But really the tipping point, no pun intended, for a lot of workers was being asked to enforce COVID protocols on the very same customers from whom they had to get tips to survive. It was a disaster. It was just impossible. Workers got yelled at and screamed at for trying to do their job, and a million workers left. And of those who remain, more than half say they're leaving, and they're saying the only thing that would make them come back is a full livable wage with tips on top. And even in Ohio, we've been tracking hundreds of restaurants that are now paying 12, 15 and up plus tips in order to recruit and retain staff.
And it works when you pay people.
It works. Yes. I mean, the turnover goes down, retention goes up, employee morale goes up. You know, you see customer spending go up because guess what workers do in our industry when they are paid more? They eat out, they spend it, and they tip better than other people because they know what it's like to work in the restaurant.
Yeah,
industry.
Former waitress and bartender here. And yes. With inflation and food prices, inflation's kind of looks like it's cooling a little bit, but food prices took one of the biggest hits. At least that's something most of us notice right away at the grocery store. What have you noticed about restaurants' willingness to shift those costs to customers instead of, cutting wages or resisting higher wages?
Yeah, I mean, we are seeing a lot of employers do really creative things during the pandemic. Look, once you raise wages, you can, if you pay everybody a full wage, there's the possibility of work in the California, workers in both the front and the back share the tips. There's all kinds of things that can happen. You see lots of savings in terms of, as I said, employee turnover. You know, I think right now there's inflation, so food costs are going up. That is the primary reason menu prices are going up. It's not because of wage increases. It's because of food prices. It's because of gas to get the food to the restaurant. You know, those are the reasons prices are going up. But I think we have to keep in mind, if there is inflation, there is only one way for workers to be willing to work in this industry, and that is if they are paid enough to survive. I mean, when the wage is a little over $4 in Ohio and a cost of a gallon of gas is closer to $5, you're not going to go to work to pay more to get to work than you get in an hour of work when you get there. You're just not going to do it.
A month or so ago, we had a program about wage theft, and that's a huge problem in the restaurant industry, especially among among immigrants, among people of color, and among people for whom English is a second language.
That's right. Listen, I mean, we have an association of 2,500 amazing restaurant owners who really care about raising wages and creating a new, responsible, sustainable industry. They are great. And they're the exception, unfortunately, because the Department of Labor has reported that our industry has the very highest rates of wage theft of any industry in the United States. And it is not entirely employers' fault. We have very complicated systems, including a two-tier wage system that requires employers by law to ensure that tips bring you to the full minimum wage. And if they don't, they're supposed to make the difference. Most employers don't know this. Most workers don't know this. And so the best thing to do is make these systems easier and cleaner and just have one minimum wage. I mean, after all, what is the point of a minimum wage? The word minimum means you're not supposed to earn less than it. So let's pay everybody a minimum wage, a livable minimum wage. And that way, a lot of this wage theft and complications that employers face would go away.
Well, and by the way, what about health care and child care? These things that, that's extremely expensive. Restaurant workers are more prone to alcohol and drug issues and all kinds of health issues related to the actual job that they do. What kind of support, how are you seeing the restaurant industry respond to all those sorts of kind of those safety nets?
Well, we are seeing, like I said, a lot of employers innovate right now. I think we're seeing some beautiful things happening. That's why I wrote that we're going through a moment of redemption, really, and reinvention. Renewal, because so many employers are beginning to realize we've lost so many workers. And the only way to have an industry where workers stay is to actually recognize these as skilled professions. You know, in Europe, you go to school for many years to be a hospitality professional. It's not that these aren't skilled occupations. It's that we haven't been treating them like the skilled professions that they are, and paying people at the skilled professions that they are. So in a profession, you have to think holistically about the workplace. You think about compensation, you think about benefits, you think about having set schedules, you think about treating people with respect and dignity, you know, reducing the screaming, you know. So all of these things, I think, are changing right now. They have to, because there's just not enough people willing to be paid and treated this way anymore.
I was reading another essay about just generally the culture in this country toward service workers, whether it's the person who's taking care of your child every day to the person who serves you your food at a restaurant. It's a cultural problem we have here. It's Americans are particularly problematic.
Yeah, and I do think that we had a glimmer of change on that when we started calling them essential, when we started saying these are essential workers, and we started clapping for them, you know. And a lot of workers said, don't clap, pay me, you know, treat me and pay me like the professional, supposedly essential worker that I am. And so I do think there was a realization on the part of consumers for a minute there. Things have to change. And frankly, I do think that's what led to workers waking up and saying, you know what? I am essential and I am a professional and I deserve to be treated this way. And so it's not just the restaurant industry where there's a shortage. There are shortages in childcare. There are shortages in every service sector. And, you know, they're not labor shortages. I want to be clear. These are wage shortages because it's not that there aren't millions of people who would take great pride in doing this work. It's that they need to be paid a wage that allows them to live and thrive and be treated with respect.
Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Saru Jayaraman. She's president of One Fair Wage, a national organization working to raise wages for service workers nationwide. We're going to continue our conversation, you know, about this. And again, we want to remind listeners that we did invite the National Restaurant Association to join today's show and the Ohio Restaurant Association. John Barker of the ORA had a scheduling conflict, and the National Restaurant Association declined to respond to join us or provide a statement in response to the New York Times essay. We'll put a link to that essay on our website at WOSU.org/all sides. Check that out. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Well-known Columbus chef and restaurateur Avishar Barua is no stranger to the ups and downs of the restaurant business and the need at times to step away and rethink the whole thing. Just as the restaurant industry is working to reinvent itself, so too is Barua. In the year since opening on season 18 of the top-rated cooking competition show Top Chef Portland, Barua has left the service bar at Middle West Spirits and is launching two new ventures. Avishar Barua joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's been a weird 2 years for the restaurant industry.
That's an understatement, yes.
you got kudos for how you managed it at service bar.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, honestly, we didn't really know what to do. So it was a group effort. It wasn't just me. It was me and the staff that was remaining. We all have made a conscious decision together to try and kind of evaluate why we were in the industry. And that's the way we went.
And you went, and why you were in it is to feed people.
Yeah, basically, we did a full switch. When we had service bar open, we had very limited seating. So we agreed not to do any delivery or carry out. And I mean, I was having conversations with people, and I would just be dismissive of it, honestly, of the idea of why would I take this amount of effort we're putting into this food, put into a box, and expect it to go out. And quickly, in a period of 4 or 5 days, it was actually on my birthday, March 15th or 16th, order came in. My birthday was March 14th of 2020. I was doing the dishes.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, exactly. I was also in the dish pit because, you know, labor has always been kind of an issue. So I was doing the dishes. One of my staff members brought me some Cracker Barrel Country Fried Steak as my birthday cake. It was wonderful. And then we got a word that we had to shut all the restaurants down. So we had kind of to think on our feet. And, you know, like I said, I couldn't have done it by myself. It was a conversation we all had. The owners of Middle West sat down with me, the service bar staff sat down, and we just said, hey, what can we do? Because there's stuff that we cannot do. We cannot have people in the dining room, but can we still feed people?
It was sad coming in to get takeout because of the dining room being closed, but it endured. What did you learn from that experience?
It was the first time that, you know, I've always kind of been a back of the house person. Mm-hmm. I started off as a server, actually, is an interesting fact, and I do prefer the front of the house aspect because I get to make someone's day better, you know, the personal interaction, and you get that instant gratification of, hey, I can do this. But in the back of the house, we're always kind of working and trying to get stuff. Like all the stage crews, we do a lot of work, and if we're doing our work correctly, you shouldn't notice anything. You should just have a good time. And now we removed kind of the rest, the half the experience. So it had to be just about the food and what we're doing with the food. So, you know, we changed the menu around to make things that we thought people were craving. And if we could bring a few moments of joy, that was the approach that we did for carryout and delivery. And it taught us a whole new model. I had heard in the past, I'd gone to some chef conventions and the discussion was always about the future is going to be, you know, in other countries. Delivery and takeout is pretty normal, but in America, you know, we like to eat in. We should allocate 40% of your dining room or 40% of your space for this future model where things like Uber Eats and such are going to start populating themselves, because it is a common thing in other countries.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the restaurant industry now and how it's changing. My guest is Abhishar Barua. He's a Columbus chef and restaurateur. He appeared on season 18 of the top-rated cooking competition show Top Chef Portland. He's opening a daytime cafe in Worthington called Joya's and has another new restaurant in the works. If you have a question or comment about the changing restaurant industry, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, I never worked in a high-end restaurant, but I did do waitressing and bartending for many years when I put myself through college, like a lot of people do, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't until I started watching Top Chef, which I loved. I was a devotee of the show. But I started to feel uncomfortable about the backstabbing meanness that was happening on a lot of those earlier seasons. Season 18 was like a revelation about how kind and warm you were toward each other and supportive.
Honestly, every single one of us left differently than when we'd arrived, and for obvious reasons. You know, we're doing cooking competition in the middle of the pandemic. Half of us, whatever, since, yeah, all of us but one got sent home. So, you know, it's all like, in the end, yeah, that's what happened. But, you know, you come to Top Chef, and you know, I'm not a huge TV person, but everyone has respect for two shows, and it was Iron Chef America and Top Chef for the two. Like, if they call your name, you show up, because you're like, that's the kind of like the peak of the TV world. And also, a lot of people watch that, so you could potentially give a positive message to the next generation, which, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about later, but that's kind of the reason that I did it. Also, at that point, there was really nothing else for us, and we wanted to make sure the industry was going to exist, so we thought we had more weight than just, like, you know, every season has its own challenges, but for us, we were the first one that was, like, living in isolation, so we had the entire production team was staying with us in the same hotel, and we couldn't break the bubble, so a lot of real life was coming into reality, is the way that I described it. And we had two options. One was like, you know, you could try and stomp on everyone, because it's very easy. We're all kind of vulnerable when we're going on there. Some of us don't have restaurants anymore. Some of us are just like, we're beaten down. We've been putting food into boxes for the last 6 months. So we're not at our chef peak, so to say. But what we saw is that we actually all were going through a lot of the same stuff. We tried to find similarities, and we agreed that we wanted to help each other out, you know, no matter what, because this is a pretty meaningful time in America. A lot of things were going on, and we could be part of the difference, or we could be part of the process. So,
yeah. Yeah, I wondered about the production staff, too, and whether they felt the difference and whether they thought, wait, we can do this, and it can be good. Yeah. It doesn't have to be combative.
I want to believe that, you know, they told us that we were the best season. I'm sure they say that every season, but we did make a lot of connections. I still stay in touch with what I found was awesome was, and this is like, I was overhearing what was going on in the conversation earlier, is some of the things that you find in hospitality in all industries is people that work in the industry, we find bonds. You know, there's a lot of good to come out of there, and it's not like a quantifiable thing. It's just you make a connection with somebody, and you know, we're in this together. And when everyone's in something together, it makes it a lot easier and a lot better to kind of work with each other.
You haven't watched. I don't know if you have or you haven't, but we kind of kicked off the program with references to The Bear.
I was avoiding watching it because I like to let things like settle down and all, like, the, you know, I post on social media, but I don't look at it that much because I get scared of, you know, what's being written about me or whatever's going on out there.
Yeah,
I'm very self-conscious.
I hear
you. So I just and it's been like blowing up all my feed. So I was like, I'll wait for it to go away off my feed until I start watching. However, I saw that a topic of discussion was that, so I watched the first three episodes just to kind of catch up and do my homework, and I read the article as well. So it is something for sure. I'm happy to comment if you'd like.
Yeah, well, I am interested in what your thoughts are about the vitriol in the kitchen, and how he tries to change that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a goal of a lot of people these days is they want to make more than just a contribution of, hey, this is just a restaurant, because we discussed it. You're not in the industry to make money. Some people are in the industry because they have no choice, and honestly, just as I believe that many should play musical instruments at some point in their lives, I think people should work in the industry just so you can see what it's all about. It's a good field to learn soft skills in, and a lot of things that you can't really learn any other ways. So it is always, I think, in a chef's mind that, hey, people are looking up to me. I have a chance to make a positive difference. Sometimes it goes in the direction of ego, and you go, well, I want to make my impact on the industry, and it's about me. And it's kind of a weird thing because technically, I guess they're being selfless because they're trying to make a change, but it's for their own gain. So it's one of those discussion points. But that falls apart when, you know, when money runs short, or if, you know, if someone shows up drunk. Like, there's things that you deal with on a daily basis, and it really tests your commitment to your staff and what you want to do. So we all want to make it better, yeah, but it's tough sometimes, because if it was so easy, then everyone would be doing it. Every restaurant would be successful. We'd be such a thriving industry, but it's not. It's when we're at our weakest often that we're challenged the most.
Huh. How have you attracted staff? I mean, what are your struggles with that at this point?
It's kind of a weird thing, is I don't try to like attract anyone or tell anyone it's an amazing opportunity or like a great place. I just know that I went through it. I know that I've worked in almost every position in the restaurant industry. I know that I've put a lot of hours in, and what I learned from is the worst moments, honestly, what I went through, and I know that I would never on my worst day ever want anyone to experience some of the things that I have in the industry. Again, I don't think it's acceptable, and you know, I don't, like, we're talking about professionalism. There's some stuff that should not be like, oh yeah, it's so cool to like go and do this or allow these things, and you know, these are the behaviors that you see on the shows, and you see them on shows for two reasons, and then I'm sure the producers are very well aware of this because they produce TV. It's something you want to watch. It's not very exciting if everyone just shows up to work on time, makes 25 sandwiches perfectly, and leaves. Like, does that right. Sound like an exciting program? Oh yeah, fired five oh, on time, nothing is late, everyone showed up, no one was hungover. Like, that's not an exciting TV program. But I'm learning through media you can make a positive impact, and it shows, like, because you know, like in the first episode he shoots a gun in the sky. That's not, people don't do that,
right?
Come on.
Right, right.
I mean, maybe they do, but
maybe in Chicago, I don't know.
Not where that shows. Also, that's another story. I'm not going to get too far into it, but not where it's filmed. That doesn't necessarily happen like that. And you know, you also, yeah, that bullet went somewhere. So there's a lot of there. You know,
I wondered about that too.
Xanax at a party, like things like that, are like, that's not a normal thing to happen. Yeah. Can I say there's been that you could make a connection where something like that may have happened? Yeah, for sure. There's certainly, but it's dramatized, so you know. So the show is, yeah, it is over the top intentionally. I know that they did a good job with consulting with people that are in the industry to get there. But I would caution against the same thing as, like, you know, we get to a point where we see something that we're like, you hear song lyrics and then suddenly two words make sense, but the whole song makes sense. Just be careful, because there's a lot of impact you can do with a program like that. I don't want people to think like, oh yeah, we can just give kids Xanax and it's cool. Like, because at the end of that episode, the consequence was, oh, it's kind of cool, it's funny. And some of us perceive it as humor, and some of us might just see that at a younger age and be like, oh, it's cool to poison someone's punch at a party. So yeah. That's, I think, the 50-50. Overall message, I think, is good, but there's always ways that we can do better, right?
You mentioned your worst time. You've learned from your worst experiences more than anything.
I think you learn from your worst. So, right.
What's your worst experience?
I have several, and it just depends on the moment and the mood at the time. But I can give you an example. I'm not going to say any names or locations,
sure.
But you know, I've been witness to people throwing people downstairs, or you know, making comments like there was a scene in the first episode of The Bear where someone's like, using, and obviously it's exaggerating, you piece of crap, you deserve to die. And you know, I've heard someone say something like that. And what was worse worse for me was that I was witness to it. It wasn't necessarily coming at me, because you know, when I approached the industry differently. I did a career change. So yeah. I had a pathway, and you know, I'd kind of matured in my college degrees and stuff, and I had a mindset.
You're going to be a doctor.
Yeah, I was trying. I don't know. That's also another. I don't know if I could ever be a good doctor, because I mess up a lot. And you know, when you mess up as a doctor, people don't like that so much. So it was that circumstance that I actually saw the stuff that you know you read about, and you go, hey, this actually isn't that cool. Someone could be seriously hurt. Someone was seriously hurt, and there was no follow-up or consequence. The worst thing for me isn't necessarily like knowing that I can control this thing or not, but knowing that if I see someone else do it, if I can't do anything about it, then it gets tough for me. Because as a chef or a business owner, you learn that you are the problem solver, you're the answer, you're the one that takes all accountability. So what happens if that's stripped from you? When we're talking about the pandemic, same thing. I can't serve people dine in now. I can't find a future for my staff. What do I do now? And that's a challenge for sure. It's very, like, that's everyone's worst nightmare, is like when you see your best friend going through something and you can't help them out. And that's how I try and treat my staff. And you know, like, there's challenges with every single person and every single time. And if we each see each other as individuals and know that we want the best for the next person, I think the rest can come together in any industry. So it's not just the restaurant industry, but I think that's what helps sometimes, because everyone's always like, hey, what's your answer? I was like, there's no one answer. It's how much are you willing to put down and how much do you care about somebody next to you?
Yeah, you know, that scene that you mentioned from The Bear it's of the lead character and his experience in fine dining. It all takes place at that Greasy Spoon sort of Chicago meat sandwich or beef sandwich,
hot beef.
It looks really good.
It's a very good sandwich. Although I would say there were some inaccuracies. They can do the best, but it doesn't look as sexy, I guess. But like they were braising the beef for Chicago beef, and how are you braising it? Unless you're doing it sous vide, how's it pink on the inside? And they're shaving it. Like, there's some inaccuracy that I saw there. I was like, that's not pot roasted beef. And also, why are you only doing like, he's like putting one in a pan. Like, you can't feed 400 people with one in a pan.
Right,
you
got to
be doing a big side of beef. So all kinds of questions on that side. But that's just another conversation.
Journalism shows kill me too.
Yeah. When you're in it on the side, it's like you get like the 75% is great, but the 25% of you, you're like, you're almost like, you should have made that more correct. That doesn't appeal to me all the way. So,
well, in that scene, he's a sous chef or something, and the executive chef is just ripping him. And we wanted to use that cut, mm-hmm. but it's so riddled with profanity, mm-hmm. illegal profanity, stuff we can't air on public airwaves, that we couldn't use it. But it was horrible. And it was in this really nice restaurant. Everything on the outside is probably super cool and genteel, but inside there it was like wild animals.
Yeah, that's from my experience, and I can't comment on everyone's, but mm-hmm. I know mine is not the only one. As I've talked to some really good chefs, and I mean, going back to Top Chef, that helped me to know that there are other people out there that went through similar things and decided to do their own thing. It's not atypical, and you would think. So when I was going to some of these Michelin star restaurants, working there, staging or cooking at them, this was like less than 10 years ago. So we're talking post 2000s. So, this is a time when you're talking about like, oh, we're modern. We care. You hear the word diversity brought up, your equity, you hear all these words. And us as young cooks were like, oh, I'm interested in that too. But, it is changing. And it's changing because this generation that's taking risks is putting themselves out there and trying to make those changes themselves. Because I do believe that you would never want someone to feel like that they shouldn't exist anymore because they messed up a steak. But I will tell you, in my life, I've had dreams, not where I was burning prepackaged foods, but like, for instance, like we got like a nuclear strike hit America, and I was worried about getting a steak cooked medium rare. That was actually my concern was like, I was like, I'm out of power. Maybe I can use the energy from the nuke to roast a steak. I don't know. Like, we're creative. We're problem solvers. So it's not like, hey, I'm done. It's like, what do I do? I got to get the steak out. That's sort of pressure you feel in those environments. And I steer away from that style of management. It's a little militaristic. In a traditional sense, because the military has also changed the ways they train people, but in a traditional sense that there's some flaws that can happen in a system, and they are exacerbated by the fact that a lot of us as restaurant employees, it's almost like it's an equitable job. If you have the skill set, they don't really care if you have 5 DUIs or you went to prison.
Right.
If you cut this thing right, you got
if
the job.
If you're good, you're good. Yeah.
So we have, we're put in the same place together, so it's only natural that maybe somebody who's now in a position of management and may... this was used to be okay. We think this is okay because we don't offer training on that sort of thing. Or how do you talk to somebody when now you have to get this sauce out? And there's a very tense moment where you can see the chef is not yelling at the cook who messed up the sauce. He's just said, hey, that's not right. It's not right. And then she went back to fix it. And of course, like as an employer and someone who's serving a guest, you want the best experience. Someone's paying $200 a dinner, $300 a dinner. You want to make sure it's right. So in that moment, we also spend ourselves and we go, what can make the best bite possible? It does not excuse bad behavior or yelling or screaming or that. It's just a question of, remember, this is a profession. Like, just like, we got to tune the things. You got to put the oil in the car. You got to produce the product at the end of the day.
That's interesting. I mean, when you think about corporate boardrooms, most of them go through business schools and get their MBAs, and they do have sort of this kind of common language of propriety. Mm-hmm. And that you make a really good point that people are coming from all different places in the restaurant industry.
Yeah,
you know,
and we're psychologically primed to fail every day. I mean, you hear... especially like you hear commonly, oh, this is the industry. You read a book, and again, like Anthony Bourdain, someone that's looked up at a lot. But when he wrote Kitchen Confidential, it was also a pretty bad thing for a lot of our industry because people are just like, you know what? I'll just do drugs, and I'll do substance abuse. I'll do these things because it's okay. It's a rock star lifestyle. It's really like it's hospitality. If it's not serving somebody else, then what are we doing? Like, go find another chef. Like, it's about somebody else. Our career is inherently about making other people happy.
That is Avishar Barua. He is a Columbus chef and restaurateur. He appeared on season 18 of the top-rated cooking competition show Top Chef Portland. He's opening a daytime cafe in Worthington called Joyas. He has another new restaurant in the works. Hopefully we can squeeze in some conversations about those because a lot of people are excited to have that have those open. In the meantime, if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The threat of inflation cooled in July, but food prices hit a 43-year high point. Unwelcome news, especially for the restaurant and food service industry, already struggling with labor shortages and calls for higher wages and better working conditions. We're talking about those struggles and the role of the behind-the-scenes culture of restaurants. Still with us, chef and restaurant owner Avishar Barua, soon to open a Bengali-American daytime cafe called Joyas in Old Worthington, and in development of another evening venue called Agni. Christopher White is the Michigan Director of Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. That's a nonprofit national advocacy organization working to improve conditions in the restaurant industry. Christopher White, welcome to the show.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Your organization is getting ready to unveil what it calls the National Restaurant Workers Bill of Rights. What is that?
The Restaurant Workers Bill of Rights is a policy initiative that we're launching, and it will unveil after Labor Day. And it is a combination of bills that's conducted that calls for a Bill of Rights that restaurant workers are entitled to good quality health care, that restaurant workers are entitled to a thriving wage, that restaurant workers are entitled to an environment that does not have a sexual harassment. And basically restaurant workers are essential workers and must be treated with a dignity.
Why is it important to put this down in writing in this way, in a Bill of Rights in that way?
Well, because we see the importance of the restaurant industry, not only within the internal dynamic of the restaurant, but as customers and patrons of what it means to families and what it means to communities. And that as human beings, we are entitled to be treated with dignity, and we should treat each other with respect and dignity. And lots of things take place at restaurants. People get make proposals at restaurants. People have celebrations at restaurants. So it's when utilizing the true human aspect, the restaurant is so important to our existence. And the workers that are there have families as well, and they have challenges that they face, as well as the people who own and operate the restaurant. So the industry, you know, we need our policy leaders and decision makers to know just how important the work is and just how important the industry is as a whole to this nation.
You know, Avishar Barua, you talked earlier about how having a company policy gave you the kind of the agency to make certain rules that benefited the workers, but maybe they didn't like it first. And I'm wondering, what about a workers' bill of rights, you know, kind of on the wall of, you know, back in the kitchen kind of a thing. What do you think about this kind of idea?
I think if it's always based on the intention and the destination, I guess, right? So if it's something that is making the quality of life better, then why would you not want to do it? That's what I would say. But also, is it necessarily something that should be excluded or was excluded? it's never acceptable to sexually harass anyone. It's never acceptable to do a lot of these behaviors. So why should we be making an exception, I guess, for restaurants? It's not, you know, like that, mm-hmm. that's where it's I think that ultimately that the way that it goes is, yeah, it's our goals as both business owners, you know, and the restaurant owners, people that are giving agency to others to come and have a good time. We say, you know, the most important thing is we take care of ourselves. Second thing is we take care of our staff. And third thing is we take care of our guests. Right. Those are, if, as long as those three things are done. I'm for it. If there's any issues, then it's got to go back to that hierarchy. Everyone's got to make sure they're taken care of first. Because if you can't take care of yourself, how are you going to take care of others?
And when you say intention, you mean just slapping it on the wall is one thing. It's, actually putting, you know.
Correct. Yeah. We were talking about it a little bit earlier is when the mask mandate was enforced, the people that you're telling to enforce it, what's the training? What do you tell them to do? And what happens if a guest comes back and snaps at them? Are you saying by me using these words, you're going to go away? Well, what if someone gets violent? What do you do next? Is there a policy that says you go to this person? Like, and whose job is it to create those policies? Is it my job as an owner? And I'm for it all, but I think it just needs to be written down somewhere for sure. Say, mm-hmm. hey, this is the way we go through it, and we need to address every facet, kind of the diamond, so to speak. Because it's not just a one size fits all solution. Restaurants are highly personalized. There's some places you can spend $500 on a burger, and some places you can spend $5 on a burger. They're both good, but with them, they have different models and they have, you know, different things that need to be addressed to get your staff in a way that they feel comfortable or empowered, I guess is the word that I'd like to say, to make a decision.
Christopher White, you also have a program called High Road. What's that about?
Yes, in addition to being the Rock Michigan director, I'm the National High Road director. And the High Road program is a philosophy that really is an ethical, pragmatic way of doing business. And again, it goes back to making sure that our servers don't have their tips stolen, making sure that people that work in the back of the house should have opportunities if they're open to apply for positions in the front of the house. It is an environment free of sexual harassment and an environment free of racial and gender discrimination. So it's an ethical, pragmatic way of doing business. That's the philosophy. And we have two subcomponents called the Child Institute and RAISE, which help push that philosophy through into being.
I guess, Avishar, that kind of goes to the whole hierarchical traditions of the restaurant to kind of break that down.
Yeah. And I guess some of what we're experiencing also as newer business owners, and I mean new in the last 20 years, we've seen a lot of changes, is we are dealing with the previous practices. That's what was taught to us.
Yeah.
And we're trying
to
break
it. It's always been done.
Yeah, and it's also like, you know, there's two things that are difficult. One is being a proponent of change, and two is like also you don't want your business to fail. And both are possible, but they come at a price, right? Nothing is free ever. Everything comes at a cost. And it's always about addressing those things. I think it's always a work in progress is the best way to describe it. Seeing something going in the right direction is a good start. And then we continue to push and we push and we follow up. We reinforce those structures. You know, every foundation is strong, but foundations can crumble. Mm-hmm. So it's always important to make sure that you rebuild them and make sure that you're seeing what's current, what's going on, or if there's a better way. You know, you start off with wood. Now cast iron's a thing. With the iron, and like there's always ways that we can find holes in our system and make them better. And I think that's like it's a great thing to have again the conversation go in the direction.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the ultimate change in culture, and Christopher Wright chime in, is that it's about accepting change. It's not about what necessarily that change might be, but the fact that the restaurant industry has been so steeped in tradition for so long, it was seen as somewhat immutable until the pandemic.
Yeah. And
That's the to a degree, the pandemic alone is a tragedy, and we're emerging out of it, hopefully, and we're all trying to do our best to get out of it. But in one instance, it's kind of sad that it took this for the industry to have to make that shift. There are people like the chef here who are already practicing what we call the high roll values. He would have no problem with a restaurant worker's bill of rights because he already practices it. There are several people in the industry that don't practice it. And we're trying to make sure that we shift the industry where it's a fair and just industry for people. And we also believe that when you practice this philosophy, it will reduce turnover. Our research shows that it will reduce turnover and that reduces your operating costs, because it costs money when you have high turnover. It costs money when you have EEOC complaints. It costs money when you have lawsuits, and it impacts your bottom line. So by just as if any other industry, if you work great with your staff, and if your staff respects the management of the restaurant, then there should not be any problems, and profit, the road to profitability is there.
Christopher, I'm wondering to what extent you are working with culinary schools to embrace these lessons and these guideposts.
What we have is we have our Child Institute, which is the Colors Hospitality Opportunities for Workers, and that's a school that we have. And we train our members and workers and people, front of the house, back of the house trainings. We have bartending classes, we have management and hospitality classes. But the differentiator is that we train them to know their rights. And when they go into the workforce, they are prepared to understand their rights. In addition, with RAISE, which is Restaurants Advancing Industry Standard of Employment, these are restaurants that already practice the high road value system. They pay a thriving wage. They don't take tips from the waiters, and they have a very good track record. So say, for example, we're trying to get some legislation passed to give tax credits to restaurants, and then there's those that may be against it, or we're trying to get an increase in wages across the board. We have these restaurants that will say, well, we do practice this value system, and it works for us. So what we're doing is we have our Child Institute, and then our graduates feed into RAISE.
Child care issues have been a huge factor in the labor shortage. People just can't, I mean, it goes, it's something we talked about earlier, where the culture in this country is not supportive of caregivers, of service people in general, and it affects, you know, everybody. What about that, Christopher White?
Yeah, that's very important, because sometimes, and Chef, I'm sure you've experienced this being a professional in the field, that you may have some of your best servers and employees, and they may not even be able to take those good schedules because they don't have childcare, and they're able to miss, and that impacts not only their individual earnings, but it impacts the operations of the restaurant. So, you know, we're working on some technological systems that will connect workers with each other and connect restaurants to daycare centers that can extend their hours and things of that nature, so workers can have childcare at these places. And, you know, we're factoring a number of things with that, allergies that children have, different style learning, so it's a lot. So when we talk about childcare, it's one thing to just say, well, we're going to have someone to watch the child, but the providers have to be very aware of the different style of learnings and autism and special needs, as well as allergies and things of that nature. So child care is crucial to the industry, the worker, the owner, the industry as a whole.
Yeah, Abhishar, I mean, child care, those kinds of things, is it practical?
Like I said, if we're approaching restaurants as a professional industry, we should be treated just like any other industry, right? Like, no more, like, that should be us. And in a lot of these restaurants, like I was saying, we have already such a diverse pool of people that will work in restaurants. And we always try, at least we do as a restaurant, and a lot of others, you know, we're always trying to find ways to accommodate someone who wants to come and work at a restaurant. We find the restaurant as a place. A lot of our staff historically have said, hey, we come here to get away from our problems, you know, and that's we create a safe space. And sometimes to set them up for that, like childcare is a huge thing. A lot of when I started cooking, and we'll say another bad example of my past, mm-hmm. was when I started cooking. It was if you have a kid, you can't work in the industry. Basically, there was employers that would legit say if you have a kid, I'm not going to hire this person. That's not acceptable. So we want to work on that for sure.
Avishar Barua, a Columbus chef, restaurateur, appeared on season 18 of the top-rated cooking competition show Top Chef. Portland, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me on.
And also, Avishar has opened a daytime cafe, or is opening a daytime cafe in Worthington called Joya's. He has another restaurant in the works. We'll talk about all that in future shows, I hope. Christopher White, Michigan Director of Restaurant Opportunity Centers United, a national nonprofit that works to improve conditions in the restaurant industry. Christopher, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.